Bits of Me, the podcast about women's bodies, all the things we should know about them, and all the stories behind them. This week, I talk to Jenny Cooper, who has experienced a tremendous amount of loss and grief since the birth of her first child, Arthur, back in 2016. Jenny shares the story of four consecutive miscarriages, explains why, in the middle of all of it, she joined the campaign to repeal the Eighth Amendment, and tells us about Georgia Penelope, her daughter who died at 38 weeks gestation. So you had your first son back in 2016, and you'd been pregnant thanks to fertility medication, is that right?
That's right, yes. When I was much younger, I was diagnosed with polycystic ovarian syndrome. Oh, yeah. So my periods were all over the place, completely irregular. I had never really kept track of my cycles at all because there was no need to. I didn't know much about it, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And we always knew that getting pregnant might be an issue. And we didn't really, I suppose I didn't know how it would go or how it would be. So we had been trying for a while, I think a year it was. It wasn't even a year we were trying. And I went to my doctor and just said, hey, this is what we're doing. You know, is there anything I can do to help support us? And she said, do you know what? You're already diagnosed with polycystic ovarian syndrome. Let's just get you the help you need now rather than waiting, which is what people usually have to do. So that was great. We went straight for fertility with the gynaes in Port Yonkila. Okay. And they were able to prescribe us Clomid after a while of trying. And it was on our second round of Clomid that we conceived Arthur.
Yeah. And is it fair to say that he was born and he was fine and you were fine and everything was fairly straightforward?
Absolutely. Now, I mean, there was, I won't say complications, like the pregnancy was hard, but I loved every second of it. I was just so happy to be pregnant. And it was the best surprise in one way, because that month I had had the bloods done with my GP and she had said, oh, no, it hasn't worked this month, kind of thing, you know. And she had done the 21-day bloods and she said, no, it hasn't worked this month. So, you know, you've got one more round kind of thing, because they don't like to prescribe you too much of it because it increases ovarian cancer chances. Yeah. So you have like a certain number of goes, if you like. Mm. And so we were like, OK, not this month then. And there was one night. We were at an event. I had had drank two beers mixed with lemonade. It was my new thing. And I stood up and I said to Dave, my husband, I don't feel so good. And I literally went from standing upright to on the floor, completely fainted.
Wow.
Fainted straight down like a ton of bricks and hit my head off a metal chair. But it turned out I was pregnant.
Wow.
Yeah. So the 21-day bloods aren't always that reliable if you are a very irregular person.
Yeah.
So that was Arthur. And he arrived like 3 days before his due date. And everything was great. It was a hospital birth. And gas and air. I didn't go for epidural or anything. He arrived and he was perfect. Yeah, he was.
And was it about a year later then that you decided to go again?
Yeah, exactly. I had this idea of having my babies close together. We are home educating Arthur, and our plan was any children we have, we will home educate for as long as we can. And it made sense as well that they would be close in age. And also I was broody as heck. Like I just, you know, as soon as Arthur came out, I was like, we have to do this again. You know, it was just amazing. So about a year later, In 2017, it was March, I was tracking my cycles, I was tracking my ovulation, the whole lot, and I got pregnant pretty much immediately. And unfortunately, 5 weeks later, or on week five, when I was 5 weeks pregnant, I was at work and I just got this funny sensation and I was having some cramping and I went to the bathroom and I'd already started to bleed. So that was my first miscarriage. It was a complete miscarriage, spontaneous. There was trips to the hospital to check it out. Of course, there was nothing that could be done. It was so early and it was just the way. The way it was going to be.
And how were you then? Were you kind of, I know sometimes when all you want is to have another baby and get pregnant, you kind of just move on and get pregnant again. Were you in that kind of place then, or were you grieving for a long time for that baby?
I was devastated. I really was. I guess after having Arthur and having a good pregnancy and a good birth and getting pregnant relatively easily, with him, and again getting pregnant so quickly for the second one, I just didn't think that there would be any issues. So I was devastated, but I did get pregnant immediately again. Within the next month, I was pregnant again.
Okay.
So it felt like I was defying the odds, you know, getting pregnant so easily. You know, you start thinking, oh, being pregnant the first time must have reset my system, you know, and I could suddenly feel when I was ovulating. I knew the signs. I knew my mood, everything. I was just totally tapped into myself. And I got pregnant immediately. And that was really scary, really, really nerve-wracking. And I went to the EPU, the early pregnancy assessment unit, like as soon as they let me in the door, basically. Yeah, as soon as they let me in the door. And had, I think, the first scan at maybe 6 weeks or so. And of course, it was like a tiny, teeny, tiny little blip on the screen. And sure, you can't know how things will be, but it was really positive at that point, because already at 6 weeks, there was a little heartbeat.
Yeah.
You know, there was a heartbeat there, and I went away feeling reassured, but also still just as worried. You know, they call them reassurance scans, but by the time you've gone home and you've got all these thoughts in your mind, you know, the reassurance.
It reassures you kind of momentarily, doesn't it? And
Yeah. Because it can just change so suddenly. And then with that one, we had another scan. I think it was 2 weeks later. And again, everything looked great. Everything looked perfect. And they sent me an early checking in appointment. So it was actually I was 10 weeks pregnant, and they were checking me in already, which was great. It just felt good as well. And it was another excuse for, it was a scan, an excuse for another scan, I should say. And I went, and we went through the whole rigmarole of, you know, the conversations with the midwives for a good hour, and then into the scan, and there was no heartbeat. The baby had stopped growing, like, pretty much immediately after the last scan. So at 8 weeks, the baby had stopped growing. That was that. And I had to have ERPC to remove that pregnancy. My body wasn't letting go. Plus, I had been on progesterone to help support the pregnancy because of the first miscarriage. I had been prescribed progesterone, and that apparently holds on more, you know, even if you've lost the baby, that your body can kind of cling on to the pregnancy and not release it as quickly. So I went for the ARPC, and again, completely devastated. It was awful, and it was just another step further away from what we wanted, you know. And then I can't even remember how long it was. before I was pregnant again. I don't remember, to be honest.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. Exactly the same thing. Baby stopped growing at 8 weeks after seeing a heartbeat multiple times. That was, again, just devastation all over again. And it just felt like, what the, you know, I was just spending hours Googling what happens, what exactly is happening to the fetus at week 8, you know, where in the development. Yeah. So what, where are we glitching? You know, what is it that my body can't give? And I never.
So that's three consecutive losses. Does that mean that they offered you some kind of support to kind of look into what had happened or what might have gone wrong?
Yes, finally, because I mean, I it's barbaric. In my opinion, it's barbaric that you have to suffer this three times before they look into it. And I know that they say it's because it's so common, but also that's another reason, you know, that's another reason to check it out for women and families.
Yeah.
But yes, they did. They had done bloods on me and found, you know, looking for clotting issues, things like that. And nothing had ever come back as a problem. But then on this third loss, again, I had an ERPC and they sent the products, I think, to France for full chromosome testing.
Okay.
So it came back that that particular baby or had an extra set of chromosomes. So it was marked down as triploidy. And presumably the baby would not have survived even if the baby had grown more.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? So although I was devastated and it was completely unfair, I did have a feeling of relief for my potential child because that would not have been a life, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So it, in a way, it felt good almost to have a reason, but then that brought worries as well because we didn't know what the cause of the other two losses. So was this happening over and over again? Mm. You know, is it a chromosome issue? And of course, the consultants were saying, oh, it really is just bad luck. This only happens once. You know, I'm so certain you'll go on to have another pregnancy and a healthy pregnancy. And you hear all of this, you know. And I did go on to get pregnant again. And I remember thinking, can I do this again? Can I put myself, my own body and my own mind through this again?
Mm.
And then the thought of, well, what does it flip and matter at this point?
Yeah.
You think to yourself, you know, it can't happen again. Okay, it's happened three times. Surely it can't happen again, you know? So we went ahead and tried again and again, another miscarriage at around the same time. And that one, again, everything was sent off for testing and came back inconclusive, basically, because the products that they tested on turned out to be my lining and products of me rather than products of the pregnancy.
Yeah.
So we have no idea. We have no idea.
So this was when, in 2018, was it?
Yeah, it was.
I wanted to ask you as well, because I know around this time you ended up getting involved with your local repeal group as well, just before the referendum.
Yeah.
I find it interesting, you know, with presumably working with a lot of other mothers, with surrounded by people who are pregnant and are having babies and talking about abortion. What was that like for you, and what made you decide to get involved?
It was hard. Sometimes it was conflicting. But also, as strong as my needs to get pregnant and make my family bigger were, I knew that there were families and women who had equally strong feelings against having families. As a child, I was sexually abused by a family member. So I know that the risk of being pregnant when you don't want to be, and I just know that it, for me, I just kept focusing on choice. It's choice. And I know women who have had abortions for various reasons. And again, it was down to choice. And I think as well, what cemented it for me was actually the third miscarriage, because I suddenly realized that if my body hadn't done the natural thing and that hadn't been a miscarriage early, that I may have been in those shoes and I may have been the one being forced to travel for a baby that I wanted, but a pregnancy that could never be. And that it was as simple as that, you know, it was as simple as that. But I won't deny that there were very conflicting feelings and judgment as well that I would have carried from my youth, as in my given ideas of what abortion is about and the type of people that get abortions and the reasons for it. Mm. So it was purely educating myself on that, I think. Mm. Yeah.
So after four miscarriages, how do you go on to try again? What were you thinking at this time?
What was I thinking? There's a question.
that came out wrong.
Yeah.
What were you thinking?
What was I thinking? No, it's a good question. What was I thinking? It couldn't get any worse. You know, I really felt that it couldn't get any worse. And my husband was so supportive and so with me. Hmm. He has older children. I have older stepchildren. And he knows the importance of having babies. And he just, you know, if I want this, then absolutely. So I have his support openly and unendingly. And my son as well is just desperate for a baby. So he's like the broodiest child. He really is. And I just needed to fulfill this idea of my family and of him not being an only child at home. So we just kept going. We just kept trying. And it was August 2019 when I conceived again. And I tell you, that was not a fun pregnancy in the early days, because it was such a mix of pure excitement that I was too scared to admit to.
Yeah.
Anxiety, fear. Already I was going like years ahead, as you do with all pregnancies. Usually you go ahead in years and you have these images and stories already pre-written in your mind.
Yeah.
And I did all of that, but internally and with great fear. Getting to 8 weeks with that pregnancy, around week eight, I was just begging EPU to take me again for a scan. You know, I was like, this is my crucial time. I need to be... I'd have moved in if I could, you know. Mm. I was up at night Googling ultrasound machines, you know, to see if I could actually somehow manage to get one, which I know isn't the answer either. But as that pregnancy progressed, you know, I had such an amazing group of friends at this stage as well, born out of the repeal movement, and they were a constant support. And a couple of them suffer from insomnia, so there was always somebody to talk to when I was having my pregnancy insomnia as well, you know. And this pregnancy kept going. We got to 8 weeks, we got to 10 weeks, we got to 12 weeks, and it was just, the further along we got, I was so aware it didn't mean anything really in the grand scheme of things, as in like the security of it. But I also knew that the further along we got, the bigger the heartbreak was going to be, you know? And I was still just fearful of a miscarriage the entire time. So I just got through, you know. I was sleeping a hell of a lot. It was a lot of hours on the couch in front of the TV with Arthur. he was desperately excited. You know, I always said to people that he's the broodiest child I've ever met. He was just so excited. And I'll never forget the day we told him that I was pregnant, you know.
How far along were you then?
I think, gosh, my memory has just depleted so much. I think we were about 10 weeks, which I suppose was risky to tell him, but it felt so good at that point that we had gotten that far. And he was so aware of, you know, our conversations and everything. And I decided at that point that I didn't want to suffer another miscarriage in secrecy.
Yeah.
You know, and although he was young, I know my child as well. And yeah, we could get through it and it would be fine. But the big thing was not keeping pregnancies and miscarriages secret anymore. I was just tired of that, you know. Yeah, so that it kept progressing amazingly, unbelievably. There was a 20-week scan. Before that, actually, I felt the baby's first movements at 16 weeks.
Yeah.
Which was just like it was just, oh, I don't even have the words. It was just amazing. Yeah. And then at the 20-week scan, again, it was an anomaly scan, and they had noted that the baby's torso was maybe a little bit longer in comparison to legs and head, but everything was absolutely fine. And it was assumed that would just even out, you know. It wasn't an issue at all, and everything was perfect. And as with my pregnancy with Arthur, we didn't find out the gender of the baby either. At this point, I was planning a home birth. I had contacted the local home birth midwife, Rebecca. Again, I had spoken to her so many times over the previous years, because I always knew that after Arthur, any other birth, I wanted to be at home. So I contacted her like super early in my other pregnancies, simply because she's so sought after and there's such a limited number of availabilities, you know. So she was delighted that things were going so well, and she had come over and we'd had a meeting about when she would take over my care and start coming more often and everything. I suppose I was still being cautiously optimistic, but at the same time, like, screaming and celebrating inside, because, like, I had my bump. Everything was just as it should be, you know. My friend Erin was to be my doula. She's like the birth queen. So, you know, to have her there with me and Rebecca was just going to be like the dream team for birth, really. Yeah. So it was just like a time of excitement. A real, real time of loads of excitement and planning.
Did you have many scans towards the end, kind of reassurance scans, or were you reasonably happy to kind of go along just with, you know, the baby's there, I can feel her kicking?
The movements and everything were super reassuring, because this baby was so active. It was just incredible. Like, I touched my tummy and instantly there'd be response back where my hand was. Just incredible. So that was so lovely. And I already knew her routine, or the baby's routine, when they would sleep, when they would play, all of it. But I still did want the scans. And I was scanned more towards the end. I think it was probably just regular once a month. And then at the end, closer to the end, I think I was there every couple of weeks, as far as I can remember. And then Rebecca was coming to the house as well, and she'd check in with me, check my vitals, and just run the Doppler over my belly as well. So it was like a two-part team, if you like, of checking that everything was going well. And everything was absolutely fine. Waters were perfect. Baby size was perfect. Baby position was perfect. Everything was just going really well. And then in the last few weeks, everything was just coming together, you know, really coming together. And I was planning, you know, where the pool would go. And I broke my kitchen tap. It's still broken. I broke my kitchen tap trying to fit the hose extension for filling the birth pool.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of these things, and putting the side cot together, and, you know, just planning and prepping and doing all of the usual regular things, I guess. Yeah.
And it was a change in movement then that made you think that something was wrong.
Yeah. There was one day, it was a Tuesday morning, and in the morning I'd woken up pretty early. Arthur had woken me up, and I felt the baby move at that time. Felt baby move around 8 o'clock, and got up with Arthur, noticed that, you know, it was baby's quiet time, which was really normal. Every morning between like 10 to noon or so, baby would just go quiet. And that was just the normal routine. And it was a sunny day, and we were busy, and we had somebody coming over to buy bees from us. We're beekeepers. And he came over, and I remember sitting outside. We were chatting about my due date and all of that. And he was there for about 40 minutes. And it, of course, COVID had started at this point as well. So, you know, we were outside and distanced and all the rest. And then he left, and I came in to start making lunch. And it just kind of dawned on me, baby hasn't started moving yet, you know. So I just started kind of poking my belly, because the baby would always respond to that. And I remembered the old advice of cold drink, hot drink, lie on your side, do this, do that. And something told me not to waste time with that, you know. Something just said, no, you need, just get checked. And it was around 1:30, I think, and I was getting into the car. I'd left my husband and Arthur at home, because we knew he wouldn't be able to come in with me anyway. And, you know, he wasn't panicking or, you know, saying, oh, I need to come with you, because he was just sure that everything was going to be fine. You know,
yeah,
there was no question.
Can I just ask how far along you were at this stage? It was very late, wasn't it?
Yeah, I would have been, I was just about to be 38 weeks gestation.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So I got in, I went out, and I said, right, I'm going to the hospital. I'll see you in a while. And I was already planning in my mind, like, you know, my tactics when I got there, and having to like push and say, no, I need to be scanned, or I need to be checked. You know, you're already working up in your mind that you might be met with opposition, or being told that you're fine without being checked properly. But it was when I sat into the car that it really hit me that, no, something is really wrong. Because I could never sit in the car without the baby like shoving me. You know, you get into this position and the baby is like, oh, no. I've got little enough space as it is without you sitting in this. So I knew that something was not right. As I was driving, I left my midwife, Rebecca, a voice recording on WhatsApp just saying, just keeping you in the loop. This is what I'm doing. I'm going straight over. And she had replied. And then I sent a message as well to Erin with the same thing, and she replied back to me, and I was listening to the messages the other day actually, and to hear in my voice the knowing, I knew that there was just something was really, really not okay. And I just said to Erin, you know, cast spells, you know, do anything, just, you know. And I remember realizing as well that, which was in a way lovely, but it also reaffirmed it. You know, she was hoping and wishing that everything was fine, But she knew my by my voice not to say to me, "You're going to be fine. This baby is fine." Mm-hmm. You know, she didn't do that because she knew she couldn't. And she knew by my voice that, you know, it wasn't fine. Mm-hmm. So the closer to the hospital I got, the more I knew that baby was not responding to the journey or to my poking and prodding. And I was just thinking in my mind, I had all these images of being wheeled straight down for a C-section, that, you know, that there would be something that they would do immediately to just get the baby out and everything would be fine. And I got there and I have no memory of going up to the ward. I just, my memory instantly goes to being in the labor ward, and they bring, for any checks or anything, they bring you into one of the labor rooms.
Okay.
And in Ballinasloe, it's like this little suite with four rooms. And I went in and they were just really kind and lovely, and they explained everything that was happening. And one of the midwives got called out, and then the other one started putting the Doppler on my belly, and she immediately, the poor thing, she just immediately started like fumbling and saying, "Oh, we'll just move it around here." And straight away I said, no, heartbeat was always detected right there, you know. And she was trying her best, and she went out and called somebody else, and they tried, and there was no heartbeat. And they called for the consultant, and I was so relieved that this particular doctor walked in. His name is Berend. He's in Ballinasloe, obviously. He's just incredible. He was the one I met after, I think, the fourth miscarriage as well. And he was just so lovely. He was such a fantastic doctor. And he did the scan, and we could see instantly that baby was dead. Yeah. And I just remember, I mean, I'd seen so many scans at that point that I could see immediately there wasn't a flicker of anything. And I just broke down and I begged him to try again and to look again. And he did. He looked again and he said, you know, he apologized and said how sorry he was. And they did bring in another doctor, another consultant, and she looked and she was just flabbergasted that, you know, she kept saying, "You felt movements this morning." I said, "Absolutely, 100%.
Yeah.
You know, she was just amazed that it could happen so quickly, I suppose. And in the meantime, Aaron had gone to pick up Dave, my husband, and dropped him at the hospital. He came up to me and we were talked through the next stages, I guess, of what would happen next. The doctor had said that it's recommended to birth naturally for my own health, to birth vaginally rather than C-section. And I said, "Absolutely, that's fine." And at that point, once I could start thinking, I suppose practically again, my fears were around the baby, my son being able to meet the baby. So they were, you know, they had said that you can wait until your body goes into labor. But I suppose that the baby's appearance may have begun to deteriorate, depending on how long that would be. So the other option was to be induced. Basically, that's what we decided. So the plan was, he gave me a medication there and then that would, I suppose, prepare my cervix for being induced. And once you've taken that medication, you come back in no sooner than 36 hours later to be induced.
Yeah.
So that was the plan. And then we came home And it was just the most bizarre experience to know that all of this had just changed and was now so different, so abruptly as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we got home, it was the evening when we got home, it must have been around 6 or 6:30, and Aaron came over to be with me for a while. And I was so exhausted, and I wanted to talk to Arthur as well, that I had said to Rebecca, my midwife, don't come tonight. She was going to come first thing in the morning to talk through with me how things would go. So once Aaron had left, we told Arthur. And of course, he was upset, probably not completely understanding the situation.
But, so he was just gone four, was he?
He was just gone four. Yeah, he was four and a half. Yeah.
Mm.
So he went to sleep in bed with us that night, as always. It was bizarre because, well, I mean, it's normal for kids. Like you tell them and they're upset, and then they're like, okay, I want to go play with this now. So it's just their coping mechanism as well.
Yeah.
And I kind of remember sitting in the bed looking at Dave going, is this normal? You know, but it is, of course it is.
Yeah.
So we went to sleep around, I don't know how I slept, but I was so, so flat, exhausted. I fell asleep around 12:30 or so, I think. And then I woke up at 3 a.m. and my waters had broken. And I was having contractions just like that. I was full on in labor. I actually woke up like singing. It was unreal. Like it really was. And it was such a shock because when I woke and I realized that my waters had gone, it was, did I dream? Everything that happened, you know, it was a real moment of why is this happening? This isn't supposed to happen now. You know, it was really, really bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got out of the bed and I woke Dave and I went to the bathroom and I came out and I was just in a constant, continuous contraction that was not stopping at all. It was intense. It was insane. It really, really was. There was no break, none at all. And I knew straight away that I needed to get to the hospital. And I called Erin immediately, and Erin was with me within 20 minutes. And she called Rebecca and she called an ambulance as well, because my contraction was so intense and not stopping that we all figured that this baby was coming right now.
Yeah.
You know, I guess in hindsight, we were all just like, call everybody because don't know what we need, you know, and it was unbelievable. Rebecca got to me and she said that, no, we definitely need to go in the ambulance because she didn't have medication. Of course, she wouldn't have the medication that I needed. And I went from never wanting medication in birth to give me everything now. It was the most horrendous experience. It was just awful. It just didn't stop the entire way from the moment I felt the first contraction. It did not give in until I got to the hospital. And that was at about 5:30, I think. I went in the ambulance with Dave following behind, and Arthur had woken up at this stage and was watching TV and he was staying with Aaron. The whole journey over was just awful. I really felt like my back was going to snap. I was really fearful that my back was snapping. Now, I had back labor with Arthur and that was intense. But I was just sure that I was gone. And finally got to the hospital and upstairs, and I think I nearly broke the poor paramedic's neck. Oh my God. Just as they were moving me onto the bed, I just had another like seriously strong contraction, and I just had clung around his neck, and I don't know what damage I left him with. If I ever find him, I'll have to apologize, because oh my god, the poor man. But they got the drugs into me immediately, and then I did have more normal contractions then, as in it would rise and fall, but they were still very intense. And the whole experience was just wrong. It was just wrong, because my body was doing this, but without knowing it, my brain and my heart didn't want it to happen.
Yeah.
I remember just being in so much distress and genuinely, genuinely believing I was going to die. I really, really thought I was going to die. And that there was no possible way of coming out of it alive. It turns out that my baby Georgia's shoulder was kind of sticking a bit. So her shoulder was kind of, so you know, her position wasn't helping her come down.
Mm.
But, you know, the midwives were amazing. Rebecca was with me. Dave, when he followed over, he just plowed on through. There was no question of him not being there, which thankfully, you know, it's only now I realize that with COVID and everything, you know, that's a huge issue for birthing parents at the moment. And there was just no question.
Mm.
Now, whether having Rebecca with me helped that, I don't know. You know, maybe she was the one to be able to swing that. I really don't know. But he was with me as well, and Rebecca and the hospital midwife, and they were great. You know, and when the baby's head had been birthed, you know, I remember putting my hand down and feeling the baby and being able to look down and seeing the back of the head. And then, yeah, then she was born, and my body was instantly relieved because all that pressure was gone.
Yeah.
And the midwife said to me, "Jenny, you've had a baby girl." And then it was just, I suppose I was so, it was like an out of body experience, even though I felt every flip a bit of it, and it was so traumatic. It was also this feeling of watching a movie or something. Yeah. Like it couldn't be me.
Yeah.
You know, like when you see something like that on TV or you hear about it, you can empathize, but there's no possible way you could fully understand it, because you just can't. You can't, your brain can't comprehend that level of trauma.
Mm.
And I just remember the moment she said it was a girl, just breaking down, because I think I turned to Dave and I said that it's my fault that this baby has died, because I did have a huge fear around having a daughter for lots of different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I had worked so hard in dealing with that through the pregnancy, because of course there was a chance I could have a daughter. And I had worked really hard on that with my therapist and with my friends. And I knew that if I had a daughter, although that there would be, I suppose, things that might trigger me, or, but you'll have that anyway, you know, no matter what, what you have. But I just felt like this is my fault. I've done this. And they handed her to me. And it was just the most bizarre experience, because I remember looking at her and thinking, why have they handed me a doll? You know, and there was something missing. There was something missing from the room. And obviously afterwards I realized it was her cries.
Yeah.
It was the silence. And yeah, it was just completely out of body. Dave was there, and while the placenta was being delivered, I gave her to him to hold, because I needed to get up into different positions. And I remember just turning my head and looking over at him sitting in the chair holding her, and he was just broken.
Hmm.
We both said, how we kept thinking that she'd move.
Yeah.
You know, we kept thinking that I saw, you know, did I see her chest rise? You know, mm-hmm. and waiting for her to cry. And then a while later, we were wheeled down to a private room on the quieter end of the maternity ward. And I was in a wheelchair and I was holding her. And I remember sort of covering her a little bit, not to hide her, but this feeling of these women who are there mm-hmm. with their newborn babies mm-hmm. are just in this state of shock and bliss. They don't need to know that this can happen. Yeah. So I wheeled down with her covered, and then we were given our room. And that first day, so that she was born the day she turned 38 weeks gestation.
Mm.
That entire day was spent with her and with the bereavement team. But also I was in another place. Like mm. I had completely split off. I know that the medication I had been given as well would have been a part of that.
Yeah.
The pethidine and morphine would definitely have been a part of it. But it was just sitting in a hospital room with a silent baby. It just defies all logic and possibility. Mm. Yeah.
What was it like when you were moving on from the hospital? So you were there all that Wednesday. What happened then?
So on the Wednesday, of course, at this point, Arthur is still at home with friends. Mm. And he's perfectly happy. Home is his happy place. And although he would have been worried or aware of what's going on, he also was content. Mm. But I had said to Dave to please go home to him that Wednesday night because I didn't want him to spend another night on his own. And Dave needed that too. You know, he had said that he needed to go to him. And we managed to get Erin into the hospital to me once Dave had left. So she came up with a few bits and she met Georgia and she took some photos. Now, photos were being taken the whole time because through Failicon, or maybe it's a Little Lifetime Foundation, I'm not sure which, they provide a camera and an SD card for families who are bereaved. And so every time the bereavement midwife walked in, she just picked up the camera and was just taking pictures. And we had consented to that. And, you know, it felt a bit like, is this strange at first, you know? But then I didn't even notice her there anymore. You know, I was just doing what we were doing. And that day they had taken her handprints and footprints and clay footprints as well. And then that evening, Dave went home and Erin came in and she took some more photographs. And while I went to the bathroom before bedtime, Erin held her. And when I came out of the bathroom, she was standing, rocking her and singing to her. And one of my fears, because, of course, she has died and there's like a cool cot provided for her to keep her body cold.
Yeah.
I was scared to hold her too much in case it changed her or harmed her. And I'm just forever grateful because Erin said to me that the only thing that you can regret right now is not holding her enough.
Yeah.
Before Erin left, she put me into bed. She put Georgia in beside me. And she put on this lovely, calm playlist on Spotify on my phone. And she took a couple more pictures and then she left us. And that night I slept with Georgia. You know, your brain does everything that it should do when you've given birth. I was waking so often to check on her. And then it was like this ton of bricks fell on me again. Oh yeah, she doesn't need to be fed or tended to, you know, in the same way that that she should. So I just go back to sleep again. And it was around 4 or 4:30 I woke up again in the night, and I sat up with Georgia, and we had dressed her earlier on the Wednesday. Dave had done it with me because I was so scared to hurt her body, to, you know, do something to her body. But in the nighttime, I stripped her down and I took her nappy off and I just looked at her and I took photos of her and I gave her a fresh nappy. And then I popped her inside my nightdress and just slept and cuddled with her again. And then at about 9 o'clock, Emma, the bereavement midwife, came in and said that the pathologist was ready for post-mortem. Mm. So that was another thing that we had spent the Wednesday doing as well, deciding.
Yeah.
Yeah, because when she was born, there was absolutely no visible reason for her death. Nothing wrong at all. No knot in the cord, nothing. She was absolutely just as she should have been. So a post-mortem was carried out on the Thursday. And then we waited. I didn't want to leave without her. There was talk of maybe having to come back the next day for her. But we waited until 8 o'clock that night. And we were told that we could collect her from this little room that's beside a chapel near the labs or whatever part of the hospital. So I remember getting dressed and packing up all our bits. And we had the beautiful box from Failacon with all of the, like, the teddies and keyrings and different little things that they provide. And then walking out of the hospital, going in pregnant and walking out with a box of handprints. It was just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And we got the car and we drove around to get her. And that was incredibly, I mean, all of it was upsetting. But I remember going in to the room where she was laid out in the cuddle cot again, or the cool cot. And she had changed so much. Like, a little part of me kind of felt almost detached for a second.
Yeah.
Because I was like, that's not my baby. But we brought her home, and Dave drove, and I sat in the back with her in the Moses basket on the back seat, and it was just so surreal. And then I got home, and my whole house had been transformed from messy everyday family ignored life to calm and full of flowers and candles lit and the fire lit, and my friends had just done the most amazing work for us. And we brought her down and laid her into her bed, and then Arthur came and met her, and we had the evening with her. And the following day, I really thought that I suppose when I feel vulnerable, I tend to close up and build walls and stick to myself. And I figured that that's how I would be over the next few days. And at that point, we didn't actually know when we would have to take her to Shannon for cremation. We had chosen cremation. But the following morning, I said to Erin that I want as many of our friends that want to be here to come and meet her. And thankfully they did, which is just lovely, because to meet her it's not that it makes her more, well, it does. It makes her more real. It does. Yeah, because she's not.
You get to share her with your friends.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they came and they met her and they touched her and they cried with me and they went again. And that Friday night at home, earlier in the day, I had contacted the woman that married Dave and I, a humanist celebrant. And she came over and we had a little naming ceremony for Georgia. She did that, and we lit candles and we just spent the time with her. You know, they had said to me in the hospital that it's our right to keep her with us for as long as we want.
Okay.
And I was worried at that point about letting go, because eventually we were going to have to do that. But how do you know when is right? Yeah. Or how do you time that so you don't have deep regrets, you know? Mm. And it was that Friday night when I laid her into her bed, and I just knew her body has had enough, that it's tomorrow is the right time.
Mm.
So on Saturday morning, the sun was up, the birds were singing, which really annoyed me. You know, of all the day, you know, we live in Ireland and we get
crappy,
rainy, shitty weather. And then on one of the most traumatic, horrendous days of my life, the sun is going to shine. You know, I was annoyed. I was really annoyed. But I woke up so early and the boys were still asleep. And I wrapped Georgia up in her blankets and I took her outside. Mm-hmm. And I took her out to the bees and the pigs, and we walked down the driveway to catch the sun pocket that was down by the gate. I showed her the garden that we were busy building, and when Erin took maternity photos of me a few weeks before she was born, I took her to all of those spots where we did the photos because we were supposed to recreate them with her. I just walked and talked to her and introduced her to everything and everyone. And then we picked some flowers. And then that day, knowing that we had to leave at a certain time, it was like the wolf at the door, you know? It was trying to get in all the cuddles that could possibly be had, and knowing that if I lay her in her casket, I'm just going to want to pick her up again. You know what I mean? Like, how do you lay her down for the last time? You know?
Yeah.
Erin had done a lot of the work for us in relation to the cremation, and a beautiful wicker basket had been sent to us from the woodland burial ground in the east of the country. I can't remember their name.
Mm.
And the top of the casket had like this gold plate with her name and the date she was born on it. And I didn't like it. So we had taken it off and I was writing her name on the little wooden plaque that was underneath it.
Mm.
And I just got so angry. I got so angry and so frustrated because it didn't matter what way I did it. It wasn't good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Dave talking to me and saying that Georgia would never think that this is not good enough. And I just remember screaming back at him that if she could think anything, this wouldn't be an issue. You know, it's just that anger of the injustice.
Mm.
But as well, I guess it was healthy that some anger came up, you know, because, I deserve to be angry.
Absolutely.
So that was how the day went. We picked flowers and laid her in the casket and we drove to Shannon. Because of the COVID restrictions at that point, it was me, Dave and Arthur were the only ones allowed to go.
Mm.
When we got there, they had a table so that we could place the casket on and we could stay for as long as we needed or wanted. And they had music playing, music I had chosen actually. And the chapel there, or the room, is quite big. It's designed to fit a lot of people in for these ceremonies. And of course, because we were such a small group, there was just a few seats laid out and the rest of the room was empty. So it was really echoey, like a huge echo. And Arthur had a bubble wand with him and he started blowing the bubbles and he started screaming her name, and I mean like yelling her name, Georgia Penelope, over and over again. And the way it echoed, it was just, I'll never forget it. Just to hear her name out loud at that moment, because we're not religious. We don't pray. We don't have prayers. We have wishes for her, but we don't have prayers for her. And it was just so beautiful to have him do that.
Yeah.
It really was. It was just beautiful to have him do that. And then the time came to having to put the lid on the casket and seeing her face for the last time. And eventually we did. And we walked out.
It's been more than a year now. How do you think about Georgia, and how do you remember her and keep those memories alive?
There's a few different things when it comes to remembering her, because often the memories come with so much sadness,
yeah,
and so much heaviness, that for a while it was almost like I was forgetting to, not to acknowledge, but to realize how lucky we are as well to have her, you know, because she's not here. And it's all completely wrong. I guess I see some other bereaved families that grieve in a different way. And they can put their loss into, put the energy of their loss into other things. And obviously we all grieve in different ways. But I question my grieving sometimes because of, you know, the different ways to do it. And I wonder, do I focus too much on the hurt and the trauma? But there is no other way for me, I think. She should be here. And we have, her bed is still in our bedroom. Arthur has his Georgia bear. I have my Georgia bear. There's photos of her up. Her urn is in the kitchen with candles. She's talked about every day. If we do something, we say, you know, I'll say to Arthur, do you think Georgia would have enjoyed that? You know, I bring her into everything. And I guess something that is really new to me is I talk about her, and I talk about my pain as well, and my family's pain. And that has been a huge help. But also I want people to know her. I want people to know she existed, because she does exist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she does. She, whether, even if she's not physically here, she is here with me all of the time. And that comes with different faces as well. Sometimes it's the sweetness of wishing she was here to experience this, or the sadness in Aldi when I see something come in that I probably would have bought for her, or the sweetness and the sadness of seeing babies her age, you know, and doing things that she should be doing now. I'll carry her with me in whatever way I can, but I guess different days mean that looks different ways. If that makes sense.
Of course. Absolutely.
Yeah. There's also battles within me as well, because there are situations or things that have happened that I question if I guess, had a part to play in her death. Through not the first miscarriage, because that was at 5 weeks. It was very, very early. But the other ones, I had purchased a baby book that was the same as the one that I had for Arthur. So Arthur's one is filled in. And I had this baby book still in its packaging because, you know, I kept having the miscarriages. And then when I was pregnant with Georgia and the pregnancy was progressing, in the back of my mind, I was thinking, you have this book, you need to fill it in. You need to record if you have this baby and they think, oh, mom didn't do it for me, I'll never hear the end of it, you know, Arthur's the golden child, you know. But I kept thinking to myself, I need to do this, but I was terrified to jinx it, terrified. Yeah. And yeah. I decided to forgive myself for that.
Mm.
And instead, in that moment, I wrote a letter to my future baby. Mm. And I wrote a letter explaining why the book isn't filled in, explaining and telling them exactly how I felt in that moment about being pregnant with them and how excited we all were and the things we're planning and the time and the love that was going into them.
Mm.
And I wrote the letter and I instantly just fell apart and broke down, and I went straight out to Dave saying, I've done it now, I've ruined it, which I know is ridiculous because we can't actually jinx things. And if my friend said that to me, I'd be like, come on, stop.
Yeah.
You know, but
yeah.
I just you know, things like that hit me and I question it. The biggest one is really hard for me to talk about, and maybe I actually won't, actually, if that's okay.
Absolutely don't. If you no, don't.
Yeah, because no, I know it's not true deep down, but there's just that sitting with me. Yeah.
You have shared more than enough. Thank you so much for sharing, Georgia Penelope. That was Jenny Cooper on Bits of Me, and this marks the end of the second season of this podcast. If you have contributed to the podcast by becoming a patron, spreading the word, or simply listening in, thank you so much for the support. You can catch up on all previous episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all other major podcast platforms. If you go and follow Bits of Me on Instagram or Twitter, I'll make sure to keep you posted whenever the wheels start turning again.